You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Welcome to the Gestalt Get Together, presented by speechtherapypd.com. Each episode has its own accompanying course on speechtherapypd.com and is available for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. The Gestalt Get Together is your podcast for discussing the state of the evidence of Gestalt language processing, associated therapy modalities, and how our field is responding to the frameworks of GLP and NLA. I'm Corinne Smoos, MS, CCC, SLP, a musical language therapist who's dedicated to celebrating while investigating Gestalt language processing, protecting the scientific method, and reducing cognitive linguistic biases about this framework and these clients that I love so much. This podcast is intended to help you embrace, investigate, and analyze your unique role in child development for Gestalt language processors without getting in your own way. This podcast is a celebration of neurodivergent learning, and we look forward to you learning with us along the way. Welcome back to the Gestalt Get Together. If you're joining me, I am so thrilled that you're here. But if you're listening on a streaming platform, thanks so much for taking a listen. This podcast is the Gestalt Get Together. It's your podcast for discussing, of course, Gestalt language processing, but also the autistic neurotype, the importance of musical language, psychoacoustics, and how our field is responding to this growing world of GLP discourse. Whether you're joining me for an interview like this episode or a research deep dive, I'm thrilled to be sharing my passion for working with GLPs with you. My name is Corinne Smoos, MS, CCC, SLP. I love GLPs. I work with them every single day, and I've had massive success using ideas from frameworks like NLA. And I also identify myself as lovingly skeptical because I want more information, I want more data, and I want more evidence. And I basically live in the journals. You don't want to know how many tabs I have open at any given time. And my goal is to synthesize exciting ideas from language, music, and neuroscience researchers so that you can grow your knowledge base and feel more confident working with GLPs. But in this episode, I'm really looking forward to an interview talking about this intersection, at least the foundations of the intersection between GLP, AAC, and self-advocacy. This podcast recording is going to be 1 hour. It's offered for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. But without further ado, I want to introduce you to my guest, Brianna. Brianna is a speech-language pathologist who specializes in working with Gestalt language processors, autistic kids. She's really passionate about AAC. And I'm excited to talk about what this intersection has meant in her work, dive into these areas together, and see what happens during this episode. So, Brianna, welcome. Tell us more about yourself.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. I'd love to hear more about your history of, you know, as a speech language pathologist, as well as what brought you into the world of Gestalt language processing.
Oh, I feel like I probably worked with probably hundreds of Gestalt language processors before realizing what exactly I was seeing, which was really exciting to kind of eventually get to that point. And I feel like it was definitely very life-changing in my day-to-day practice and really shaping the way that I practice now and kind of started my journey to private practice. But I actually got started as a speech language pathologist assistant, and I did that for a few years and primarily worked in the school setting, briefly within the clinic setting and home health for a little bit before transitioning for the school system. But I worked a lot with a different population of students from 5 to 22 with varying support needs, many of whom were Gestalt language processors. I didn't know that at that point, and I was implementing a lot of things that I know now was probably not in the best interest of their development towards self-generated language. But I think that conversation that really sticks with me and I think about often now is I remember being in the therapy room with a couple of my other colleagues at the time and trying to brainstorm exactly what else can we do aside from providing access to alternative modes of communication? How better could we support these Gestalt language processors? Aside from what I was doing at the time, which was just acknowledging the echolalia and then redirecting, hey, we're not talking about that right now. You can tell me about that later, and moving on. And then I came around to the idea of Gestalt language processing, I think, in the same way that a lot of other speech therapists did, which was kind of falling into the rabbit hole on social media and coming across accounts like Meaningful Speech, your account, and a couple of other accounts that were really impactful, like I said, in the way that kind of shaped my private practice and learning about Gestalt language processing and transitioning into using both of my interests now, which is AAC and Gestalt language processing, and really developing an approach that I feel like is affirming and respectful, and that kind of blossomed into my private practice. But that's kind of been my journey to now.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about, because I know I have my own experience with how my relationship with AAC has changed from the start of my career. Can you share about what that's looked like for you? Like, what has your relationship with AAC looked like over the years?
Yeah, I think that very early on, especially as an SLPA, a speech assistant, I, of course, was under the guidance of my supervisor at the time and very much learning with her mentorship and guidance. And I think that because of the student population I worked with, which had higher support needs, a lot of the student population was non-speaking and used AAC as their primary modality. I had that idea that AAC equals non-speaking. And that it wouldn't necessarily be appropriate or necessary to give access to AAC to someone with mouth words. And so I think that was probably the biggest and most impactful shift in terms of AAC implementation that I've kind of gone through as I've learned and grown as a therapist, which is interesting and kind of funny to reflect back on now, because that is absolutely not true. Anybody can benefit from AAC. And I think that I don't think I know that most of every one of my clients, whether they're using mouth words as a primary modality or using AAC as a supplemental form of communication, like everybody benefits from AAC. We all use AAC in some way, shape, or form, whether that's texting or emailing. And I think that changing my perspective from that on who can benefit from using AAC and why.
Yeah, I'll never forget the moment when I started working with the oldest client I worked with at that time. I wanted to push myself and not just work with early intervention and preschool. And I came into working with this child when they were at, you know, like stage three, stage four, playing right on that line. And I was like, okay, well, you know, he's using a lot of mouth words. Like, I didn't think AAC immediately. And then a couple months in, it just hit me. I was like, what would happen? What would happen if I brought in, and we end up using cough drop. Have you ever played around with cough drop before? That was one of my go-tos, yeah, for a while. It's a bit too glitchy for my taste these days, and the kids get really frustrated with the glitching and the delay. But at that time, I was using it all the time, and I brought that in. And I mean, the look on this kid's face, he was like, he had access to all of the single words in front of him. And at that time in stage three, with all the isolations and figuring out the, you know, those early developmental like sentence types, it like opened up a whole world for him. But I had that kind of bias in my head that this child is speaking, we don't need AAC. And then AAC kind of cracked everything open for our relationship too.
Yeah. I love that. I love that you said that. Like, what's the worst that could happen is what they get access to more language.
Yeah.
I feel like there is no worst case scenario when you give someone
Yeah.
access to language.
And it opened up categories that, like, I would have never thought, like, oh, this kid would love talking about natural disasters. And that turned into like the, that was like the inflection point for us, or the turning point, pardon me, was we bonded over like making stories of natural disasters where like his stuffed animals like got into a flood and fell off the bed. And, but I would never think to open up that topic without him literally opening up that folder.
Yeah.
All right. So AAC, GLP, I want to find out more about maybe a client. When you think of GLP AAC, what client comes to mind?
Oh, I feel like I have a client that was one of the first clients that I decided to kind of shift away from that mentality that I had for a long time of, well, you know, they're using upwards, they're fine, they don't need AAC. It was a client, he was a little bit older than the population I primarily work with now, which is mostly early intervention. He was about 11 when we started working together. And he had many mouth words, mostly immediate and some delayed echolalia. And it was very unintelligible. And a lot of it was scripting Disney movies. He's a huge Disney fan. And the first day that I kind of decided to, well, what's the worst that can happen? I'm just going to bring it in and see, you know, what comes from it, because I felt like I was kind of stuck in, well, what else do I do? We keep working on, at that point, I was already implementing strategies, NLA strategies, and we really weren't making very much progress. And implementing AAC was so wild to me because the amount of self-generated language that he had with using AAC was vastly different from day one of implementing and introducing AAC. I and the family had no idea that he was actually reading. So that opened up the door to so many new topics, and we didn't realize the extent of, again, how much he was reading, but also his spelling abilities and his attempt to try to spell. And I feel like that was such a game changer because we realized some things that we just didn't know. The more that we kind of implemented AAC, one of the things that just breaks my heart is he had been eating the same exact breakfast for years, is just the Eggo waffles every day, you know, toaster waffles. And he eventually let us know that he doesn't actually like waffles. So
Oh
that was something
my
that,
goodness.
yeah, this poor kid was eating waffles for years and just accepted that as part of his routine because he loved routine. But he was actually wanting to expand beyond that. And because, I mean, to this day now, he is still very much echolalic and doesn't have a whole lot of self-generated language. This is a child that you would think, oh, we need to increase the amount of gestalts for different communicative functions. That's great. That's awesome. Yes, but access to that spoken language is not always super easy for, you know, whatever reasons. But with AAC, we've been able to have back and forth conversations and really just get to know him on a different level, as simple as maybe you don't like waffles and maybe you want something else, and having access to that language rather than what was the bulk of our interactions, which at that point his family was really reliant on kind of binary options. Do you want water or juice? And it was that immediate imitation of water or juice, water or juice, and then kind of responding with the last option. Do you want juice? Juice, okay, and kind of moving on, where in reality, we might not even want juice, even if we do say juice, okay, you know? So it was very, very eye-opening for me. And I think that he will always, always kind of stay with me as someone who kind of shifted my thinking into, wow, maybe this could actually be life-changing for some of the other clients that are using mouth words and I haven't provided access to because of that assumption, right? That harmful assumption of, well, they have mouth words, they talk enough, right? And they don't need access to AAC. But what if we do? What if we give access to AAC? What more would we actually talk about?
Yeah, I feel like it opens up different channels or different doors. And like, if we're only looking in the doors that are already open, we're like, okay, we've got rooms. But like, what if there are other doors to open? We realize like the house is much bigger than we thought.
Yeah.
It's always really cool to see. Like, I love anecdotes like that, because I think we can like hear a really compelling anecdote and then jump outward from there to big ideas. And there's, I feel like so many clinicians who work with Gestalt processors, they have the, I mean, every clinician has like those kids that stand out, but there are those clients where it just hits you of like, oh, this worked. And I feel like it has a domino effect on the rest of your clients. So another area that we were going to talk about tonight is self-advocacy. And I'd love to hear more about what self-advocacy means to you, as a clinician in the general sense. And I'm noticing that Brianna's video has gone off, so we're just going to give a moment or two in case maybe her Wi-Fi glitched or maybe her Zoom is logging out and logging back in. So while we're waiting for Brianna to return, there is a study that... Oh, welcome back. Hey.
Hi, sorry. It's really
How
cloudy and it's been raining on and off here in San Diego, so my Wi-Fi is kind of spotty.
It happens. It literally happened to me at the last episode I recorded, so it is no worries. I'm just glad you're back. So where we ended was talking about your previous client. And I think the waffle story kind of captures this idea of what self-advocacy can lead to. Now, a waffle might seem like a cute, kind of silly example, or you might see it as more serious of like, oh my gosh, this kid was eating something he like didn't necessarily even really love. But self-advocacy can also push us into some more serious directions as a field. And I think it's really important to talk about. I know working in early intervention with young children, I mean, even, you know, middle school, high school age, there can be a lot of cute stuff that we do. You know, a lot of SLPs are kind of famous for making like really cute activities, like keeping it really fun. But there can be some really serious parts of our job. And I think self-advocacy can be a place where that we can shine a light on that and be really supportive of some of the darker sides of life. When you think about self-advocacy and promoting that in your clients, just start to paint a picture of what that looks like for you as a clinician.
Yeah, I think that for a long time, what self-advocacy or what I thought self-advocacy was really the basics, right, of being able to advocate for yourself by communicating your likes, your dislikes, something as simple as I don't like waffles, right, and telling people if it's, you know, pertaining to sensory needs, it's too loud, it's too bright in here, and kind of keeping within that realm. And I think that I started to kind of think about other things beyond just personal sensory needs and likes and dislikes after attending a virtual conference in 2021. It was a conference by Gemma White, excuse me. She's an SLP, and she had a presentation called Where is the Penis? And she really talked about the importance of having body parts that are not typically programmed within AAC devices and the impact that it can have on AAC users. And so I think that really kind of helped me go beyond just the basics of advocating for likes and dislikes and no, stop, help, and things like that, but really considering like how much more we can support advocacy needs in regards to bodily autonomy, like making sure that access to language is there and accessible, whether a you know, a Gestalt language processor has access to that in form of mouth words, or making sure that they have access to that language with the AAC systems that we're providing, but going beyond that and making sure that they can advocate in different settings, whether that's a medical setting. Can they advocate for themselves pertaining to their medical needs, even as a child, right? If this child has allergies, if they have a life-threatening allergy, can they communicate that? Are they able to communicate in situations that maybe we don't think about every single day and we hope to not think about, but reality is that sometimes we encounter situations like wildfires. We just had massive wildfires here in LA County, and hurricanes and natural disasters that are just, you know, happening. And I think that that is something that we need to consider when we are talking about self-advocacy needs and how we kind of approach programming AAC devices for Gestalt language processors and AAC users in general.
Yeah, I think you're on it with that, and referencing all the different ways that like emergencies, medical needs can create these conditions where access to certain types of words or units of meaning can be really critical, even, you know, life or death in some situations. And none of us want to think about those things. I think like forensic speech pathologists, they're always thinking about things like that. And I think, gosh, with like early intervention, families of younger kids, but you can really imagine anyone broaching those topics with your speech pathologist can be pretty uncomfortable. I'm curious if you've had families you've worked with where these topics have come up and it's been uncomfortable or difficult to navigate with them.
Oh yeah, I think it's been probably more than a handful, I feel, especially with some of that, the body parts, because a lot of systems, unfortunately, still don't automatically program them. When I am talking about programming and some of the things that we want to immediately program in order to have more AAC buy-in and to make AAC something that is actually a tool for communication and not just seen as a demand or something that's forced upon. But aside from adding all of the exciting things, right? Like your favorite TV shows, your favorite foods, like let's talk about things beyond that that we might want to include. And some of those more pertaining to safety with my younger population is really personal information, right? Can we relay personal information? My name is Brianna. Can you say that? Do you have access to that? Do you have access to communicate information if they were to wander, elope, if they're lost in a grocery store? Can you communicate your caregiver's information? My mom's name is blank. My mom's phone number is blank. And having that already pre-programmed, and amongst all of those, you know, things that we're considering programming is also programming penis, program vagina, right? Put in those words into their device. And kind of starting to move beyond just, hey, program this, but how do we model these words? Because you can't just program it and expect that we're going to be able to find it in the moment that we need them if we are not actively modeling these words and these phrases within natural and everyday interactions with this person. So really trying to figure out different ways to bring up those natural opportunities for modeling in different formats. And what I mean by that is not just, for example, using body parts while we're talking about cleaning our body, right, in the shower or while we're getting dressed in the morning, but also maybe incorporating that into the books we read or the music that we're listening to. I feel like one of the songs that I listen to a lot and I recommend to a lot of my families that seems to be a pretty big hit with a lot of my younger kids is the Body Boundaries song by Hopscotch Kids. If you have heard of that one, Corinne, it's amazing. I love it.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll find the link for that one.
Look that one up. It's amazing. I've had so many GLPs really enjoy that. And I've had a lot of GLPs actually seeing that as one of their first gestalts for self-advocacy. There's a lot of really great ones in there. But my point with sharing that is like just bringing up these conversations and modeling with different ways, right? Whether that's music or reading, if we're, just navigating it within our conversations with daily routines like bathing and really making sure that we're making an effort into setting up our AAC users for success. So in the moment, they're able to access that language, especially in situations where stress is increased. If you are lost in a grocery store, your access to language is probably going to be a lot more difficult. But if you have that motor plan
Anna,
established
I
for
want to
how
let you
to get
know your
there.
audio has cut out briefly.
Can you hear me now?
We still don't have it. So let's give it a moment. But something else you might try is popping out and popping back in. That might work. Oh, you guys can hear her? Oh, thanks everybody to all of our live listeners. I appreciate it. Must be something on my end. Thanks, everybody, for being so flexible. I appreciate it so much. I'm curious for those of you who are listening live, this would be a good opportunity to throw in a question in the chat or the Q&A so we can start preparing for any of those. I can start gearing up for it. And I'm curious what our live listeners, what your reactions are so far to this topic, because this can be quite an uncomfortable topic for some clinicians. And I'm curious to know what everyone's thoughts are.
Can you hear me now?
Right, welcome back. I'm unable to, but I'm thinking everybody else can. Can we get some feedback in the chat? Brianna, can you try one more time? Great. All right.
Yay, I'm glad you guys
There
can hear me.
we go. Yeah. And you know what? It was on my end. So I was just thanking our audience for being so flexible with everything. I appreciate you guys. All right. So, we were thinking about these uncomfortable conversations with families around programming, or gosh, even just talking about what would modeling language around this look like. And you're talking about different contexts for modeling. And you mentioned like videos and songs. And what popped into my head immediately for that was the utility of providing this information in something that could easily or more easily become a gestalt. Because when you're providing a video or a song, you're providing very clear demarcations of information starts, information ends. The autistic processing of the passage of time can be quite different than the neurotypical processing of the passage of time. And finding ways to create markers in the passage of time can be really, really helpful for like chopping up what a unit of meaning is. A song naturally has a clear mark for beginning and a clear mark for end, and they're very consistent. They sound the same every time, except for maybe volume differences. A video on YouTube has a very clear beginning marker of usually silence and an end marker of silence, and it's exactly the same unless volume differences. Or if your GLPs are anything like mine, speeding them up or slowing down videos to study them. I have a lot of GLP clients who will play with like speeding up in slow-mo. But presenting this information about the body in these formats, I think, can help them be acquired as a gestalt, rather than maybe starting with like practicing just naming things, or like the like declarative naming, embedding it into a potential gestalt is possibly going to be easier to call upon, and then exactly what you said about in the more stressful situations. What I see, what I hear most other clinicians report is that when Gestalt processors have elevated stress, elevated cortisol, they tend to go back to their stage one Gestalts and reference those. They're easier to access. And so if we're equipping them with more stage ones, or more Gestalts related to that embedded self-advocacy vocabulary, hopefully that'll be easier to call upon in moments of stress, in moments of fear.
Yeah. And I've actually seen that with a lot of my clients, is really going back to that song that I mentioned earlier. I hope that it was able to come across. I don't know if I cut out then, but that was a song that I've had a lot of kids kind of pick up as a gestalt. And there's plenty of really awesome phrases in there. But aside from that song itself, like coming up with your own song, right? Mm-hmm. I've come up with songs based on personal information. And I think that those are much more accessible, especially in those moments where we are so stressed out and maybe access to language decreases. I've had a lot of kids in the school setting access some of those musical gestalts in the school setting if it becomes too loud, and voicing in a song, right, that they need space or they need to get out of the classroom into a quieter space. So I think it's important to kind of consider what might be the most accessible way to kind of access that language, whether it's incorporating recordings, right, of the actual song within their device and making that a lot more meaningful for them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Putting in or embedding songs and videos is a big go-to when I'm thinking about programming, because it is closer to that, what I call like the original source material, the original raw material. The acoustic signals, if you're putting in a recording or a video, are going to match up better rather than, you know, the generated voice. What the kids, a lot of my kids call the robot voice, isn't going to have the same emotional, like the same emotional saliency as the original song or the original clip. I'm really curious about, because every clinician has different preferences, different patterns of AAC recommendations. What are some of the programs that you really love to use with clients?
I feel like I really try my best to not be navigating to the same exact programs and recommending those, because truly everybody is going to be different and the person's needs are going to be different, and you don't want to automatically recommend the same exact program because you know the program, right? Or because you feel more comfortable with this specific app. And trying to take into consideration what exactly is that person's need. Something that's always at the top of my list, right, is taking into consideration that individual's home language or home languages, since I work with a lot of bilingual families. But a lot of the programs that seem to work well with my current population and their needs, some of the most frequent are like TD Snap. They have a really great bilingual vocabulary system that they recently released. I also have had a lot of success with Lamports for Life, a couple of the different Touch Chat vocabularies, ProloQuo2Go. So I've worked with quite a few different ones. And I think sometimes we have that mentality of, well, this specific program is better for Gestalt language processors, but that's not necessarily true. I think that the same exact considerations you would take when determining the best AAC app or the best AAC system would go across whether a person is considered to be a Gestalt language processor or not, and taking all of those considerations before we kind of jump to an app, and considering those things of what is, you know, who are their communication partners? What languages are they speaking? What features would they really need access to? Do they need to have the audio recording. Does this have, is it robust enough? Does it have a keyboard that's accessible to them? And there's a lot to think about. So that's a very great answer, but I think that it's not a black and white response. It's a very gray answer. We have to take a lot into consideration when giving access to a specific system.
Are there any forms of AAC that you haven't recommended in a long time?
Yes. I do not recommend the picture exchange communication system. I want to clarify that what I am talking about and referencing here is an actual protocol, right? It's the shortened is PECS, and I think a lot of people confused PECS and think that that is just a picture symbol or visual supports, and that is not that. I am talking about the actual protocol where you physically exchange a picture to communicate something. It is a modified ABA program where there is implementation of hand-over-hand prompting, where you are physically manipulating a person's body to help them create that initial exchange in those early stages. So that is something that I recommended plenty in the past and absolutely do not recommend anymore.
Can you share more about why you don't recommend it anymore?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest reasons that I don't recommend the picture exchange communication system is because it does violate bodily autonomy. And today we're talking a lot about the importance of self-advocacy, bodily autonomy, and the impact that that can have on our clients in a huge way, right? And in the beginning stages of the PECS protocol, like I mentioned, they are using physical prompting in order to create that exchange. And I think that the harmful implications that can have are just really dangerous. You don't want to teach a child, an individual who has difficulties with communication, that it's okay for anybody to come and touch your body without your consent. I don't think that we should be teaching that in with whatever AAC system that we're implementing, right? Whether that is a robust high-tech AAC device, if it is a low-tech communication board, we should never be violating bodily autonomy in that way where we are physically manipulating somebody's body in order to force communication, which in my opinion is essentially what we're doing. We're forcing that interaction, and we should really be fostering natural and authentic communication in order to communicate overall, but also foster those self-advocacy skills and start building the skills necessary to advocate for yourself and really teaching and honoring that bodily autonomy.
Yeah, I think about with bodily autonomy, with things like consent, that naturally brings my mind to. I think many clinicians have heard either of the statistics or related to the statistics, pardon me, about children with disabilities in general, with the increased risk or experiences of abuse. And within that population of autistic children. And I think it's important to at least touch on now. I'm by no means an expert in this area, but it's definitely related to what we're talking about with self-advocacy. And there's a paper I do want to reference. It's from 2024. It's called Adverse Childhood Experiences and Autism, a Meta-Analysis. And it's by Hartley, Sirwas, Purrington, and Raby. And they found that for individuals with autism, they were more likely to have more ACEs. ACEs are those adverse childhood experiences. And people with autism, there was moderate certainty evidence that they were at more risk for having an increased amount of ACEs than non-autistic individuals. So that was one stat. I just one paper that I wanted to pull related to it. Can you share your thoughts on this intersection of disability and increased risk for ACEs and abuse?
Yeah, I think that we are absolutely responsible as SLPs to really helping to prevent that in the way that we approach our implementation of AAC and just the way that we're supporting individuals in general overall. Because, kind of going back to what we just discussed on navigating through what AAC systems we want to provide access to. If we are introducing systems that have in place a protocol that violates bodily autonomy, what exactly are we teaching our clients, right? And if that becomes an okay situation and thing for us to do, then that opens the door for really harmful situations and dangerous situations that they might not be able to differentiate whether this is an appropriate interaction or an inappropriate interaction. Now, I don't know if you also have seen this as well, Corinne, but one of the articles that was referenced in that 2021 presentation that I had attended was actually an AAC research study where they did a survey of 40 adults who were using AAC, and I thought it was horrible. In this survey, they had 45 of those 40 adults that had experienced some level of crime or abuse, with 97% of them knowing their abuser. 71% of them were hurt more than once, and 66 experienced different kinds of abuse. So I feel like knowing that, we really, really want to be extremely intentional in the way that we are approaching the way we support our clients and not ruling it out as something that's not that serious. I've had this conversation with several other members of the team, whether that's family members or other therapists. And I think that that's something that I've received feedback on. Well, I'm just helping them find the word right on their device. I'm just helping them. They couldn't find it, and so therefore I just quickly grabbed their finger and did that. And it doesn't seem like it's that harmful, but if you look at the full picture and the possibility of things that we could be implying with the way that we are approaching things, it is really that serious. And trying to change the way that we're approaching things to really try to do our best to decrease the percentages that are very real and decrease the likelihood that we could put our clients into those situations where they're not able to differentiate safe versus unsafe situations.
And I think it can start in kind of in ways that feel really innocent and like, and they are, you know, but it can transform over time. I think about something I had to unlearn and I'm still working on it is not labeling the emotion that I assume a GLP or an autistic client is feeling, and reframing the way that I'm talking about it. Like, I think that you are. I notice you might be, rather than you're mad, you're sad. Even like pushing a child into like, this is what you're feeling right now, and trying to like modify the truth of what their body is experiencing. I feel like that can be a place where it starts too. And we could just see it kind of like shift over time. And I think Rachel Dorsey is someone who spoke about this in detail of like, don't tell people what they're feeling. I think there's other effective ways of teaching like what emotions can be called that aren't just you're this, you're this. So I
Yeah.
think it's kind of a place to think about like, where could my modeling and the way that I'm modeling potentially lead to this child maybe receiving undue influence about what their body is experiencing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, I'm wondering if I found what you're speaking about. So there is a paper, it's called From Alternatively Speaking, Speaking Out Against Abuse, and it is about people who use AAC and their survey results. Yeah, 45% of those who took the survey experienced some crime or abuse. So I'm definitely gonna put that link in here for our live participants. And definitely something I'd like to read. You know, there's a question that came in. We can either answer it now or take some time and answer at the end. It's, are you opposed to physical prompting in general or just when used related to communication in AAC? Do you want to speak on that now or take some time to think about it?
Yeah, I can speak on that now.
Sure.
I think that the answer probably would be different depending on who you ask. I personally do not provide any form of physical prompting ever. I am not even physically prompting to get up on a swing. If I have a caregiver present, which I require in my private practice, I do not ever put hands on a client unless it is for safety, extreme safety situations. I have a lot of clients who are eloping. So in those situations, of course, if they're running out into the road, I'm going to physically hold them back and put hands on, just to make sure that they are safe and okay. But in terms of AAC, I do not provide any form of physical prompting. I know that some people implement kind of a hierarchy on kind of, you know, do this and then fade your levels of prompting. I do not implement physical prompting at the earlier stage before fading off that physical prompting. Aside from violating bodily autonomy, I think it also creates a risk for prompt dependence. And I, unfortunately, early on in supporting AAC users, used a lot of physical prompting, and it was really, really difficult to let that go, where I had a lot of students who would use their device extremely well, but only if I can grab your finger and have you help me navigate through that. So I think there's many reasons why I don't use physical prompting aside from that prompt dependence, but also just learning the simple motor plan for that, right? If I'm always helping you find that, how do you truly create your own way to get there without my assistance? So I think it's really important for us to fade levels of prompting, right? If we need to have them in place to support them as best as possible, I think that's totally fine. But there are other ways to go about that other than violating somebody's bodily autonomy.
And I think it's also because immediately what pops into my head is thinking about motor differences, the overlap with autism. Yeah, and I'm noticing Brianna is frozen again. So let me just talk a bit about motor. So the motor differences, the overlap in autism and motor differences or challenges is, I don't have an updated stat on it, but it's there. And I know many of us who work with autistic kids, we see it. And so if you're worried about, okay, well, my client has these motor challenges that are going to impact access to AAC, what do we do about that? Shouldn't I be using physical prompting, physical supports? This is where, if you're able to, I recommend bringing in an occupational therapist, a physical therapist who could potentially help you brainstorm, how do we create the right conditions for this child's body to access the AAC, to press buttons, to access the screen, to text, and, you know, either to build those muscles, to build a motor planning there. But if you're able to have that more, the team approach, I think that could help, help you make better informed decisions about that tough intersection between, I don't want to violate or interfere with bodily autonomy and maybe teach these patterns that other people can do with my body, whatever they want. But also the truth of, autistic bodies very often do have motor differences. So this paper, I think it's the one that Brianna referenced. So it's from Alternatively Speaking, Speaking Out Against Abuse. It's by Sarah Lever, Lee Lightholder, Diane Nelson Bryan, and Allison C. Carey. And I want to share a little bit about this. There's actually a project related to this. It's called End the Silence. And it is a project from Temple University. It's the first research project that specifically looked at the experiences of people who use AAC as victims of crime and abuse. And so End the Silence did the survey that Brianna was referencing. They found that, like she mentioned, 45% of those who took the survey experienced some crime or abuse. And education didn't make a difference. Income didn't make a difference. And actually, there were similar rates between women and men. 50% of women, 44% of men. And they're sharing about how older individuals who were surveyed were more likely to report victimization. But that then they also clarified that just might be because they'd have more years in which years of life where this were likely to happen. So I wanted to make sure we had a little bit more insight into the paper that was referenced. You know, another thing I was thinking about as I was hearing Brianna share that came to mind was, you know, these motor differences, these body differences. And we're thinking sensory systems and how sensory processing can be so different in the autistic neurotype. It can be so different in a Gestalt language processor, because we describe a lot of autistic individuals as Gestalt language processors. But when it comes to being able to talk about the body, whether that is something innocuous like my belly hurts, or something really scary, like something really scary happened to me. There's a quote from a paper, it's an editorial actually, it's from 2020, and it's called Comorbidity and Autism Spectrum Disorder. It is by Manuel Casanova, Richard Fry, Christopher Gilberg, and Emily Casanova. And I thought this quote was really powerful and kind of a powerful framing of where some of these challenges might come from. And this is a paragraph that I'm probably going to reference in the future when I'm talking to families or other therapists to kind of ground their understanding of why it can be really hard to talk about pain, but also maybe hard things that have happened to parts of the body. So the quote goes as follows. Symptoms of comorbidities in autism spectrum disorder may be atypical and are often difficult to recognize. I'm going to pause the quote there because when we think about comorbidities, this is a term referring to when there are co-occurring or overlapping challenges, perhaps of different body systems, perhaps one that's developmental, one that is based in physical trauma, one that is GI, sleep. There can be lots of different overlapping challenges. And these comorbidities can really have an impact on how bodies are talked about. So, Brianna, I was just starting to share a quote from an editorial about comorbidities in autism, because I think it relates back to the ability to talk about one's body. So, all right, you ready to hear it, Bri?
I'm ready.
All right, cool. So, symptoms of comorbidities in ASD may be atypical and are often difficult to recognize. A major culprit propitiating these diagnostic difficulties is communication problems. In ASD, 15 to 20% of individuals are unable to speak. Furthermore, 90% of ASD toddlers are unable to point proto-declaratively or proto-imperatively. Indeed, many individuals with ASD are incapable of pointing to the source of their discomfort, find it difficult to attend to or detect bodily sensations, have poor integration of body scheme representation, I definitely want to talk about that, and have atypical sensory perceptions or reports of pain. This inability to communicate pain or discomfort to other people may propitiate the enactment of inappropriate behaviors as a way for patients to express themselves and attract attention to their plight. All right. And once again, that's from Comorbidity and Autism Spectrum Disorder 2020 by Casanova, Fry, Gilberg, and Casanova. All right. Any immediate thoughts from that quote?
I would love to read that. Yeah, I think that it's really important for us to take that into consideration too, like when we are determining the best way to
I think maybe, is there a different microphone you can switch to? Sometimes on Zoom, you can switch the microphone. Sounds like you're, someone said it sounds like you're underwater and it's very faint. It's okay. You know what I love? We're talking about communication challenges and we got to figure out our own. So while Brianna is navigating this, this is a good moment to pause and reflect on what you've heard so far. That quote about this idea of this body scheme representation. So let me read the portion of that quote again. A poor integration of body scheme representation. I'd love for you, for those of you who are here live listening to the episode, if you have any thoughts about how you might observe this in the clients you work with. Have you observed anything where it makes you think, oh, wow, I don't think my client has a strong understanding of their body scheme or where their body is in space? And if any of you have any examples of that, please feel free to share it in the chat. It's always really helpful to hear examples so we can integrate this knowledge and these ideas. And I know for me, kind of picturing your clients and picturing a child in front of me is a really helpful way to remember this information. Another part of that quote I'd be interested in you reflecting on and potentially sharing about is having atypical reports of pain. How are they communicating pain if they don't necessarily have certain types of language for it? I know with Gestalt language processors I've worked with, they might act out a scene from a movie or a show where the character is experiencing some sort of pain or discomfort or fear. They might act out gripping their stomach, like, gosh, I can't think of a specific character right now. They might fall down like a character in a show. And some really savvy examples are when a Gestalt language processor might reference a song lyric that includes a body part in it.
I try again. Can you hear me
Oh,
now?
you are sounding fantastic. We
Wow.
are communicating. You know what?
Wow.
We could have been using AAC this whole time.
We really could have. We might as well have, man, of all days. It's raining, it's clouding, my computer's glitching. Goodness.
I was just talking to a mom earlier today. She's a mom of a GLP who also has oral motor difficulties, a lot of comorbidities, like we were just talking about. And she was like, Corinne, this whole process, they're getting ready for a big surgery on Friday. So mom's feeling very reflective, nervous, but proud of how she's prepared. She just goes, you know what, Corinne? I never realized how much I took for granted talking. I never realized how much I took for granted that my mouth just knows what to do. And I think about like experiences like this on technology where like things keep going wrong. Like, it's another example of like taking for granted certain parts of communication. And I don't know, I like to find an analogy in anything of like, I wasn't just gonna give up and hang up or tell everyone, all right, guys, pack it up and go home. We're gonna figure this out. And like I feel like bringing in the kind of patience of like, I feel like a lot of people who might be attending of like, all right, let's wait for it to come back online. That's the same kind of patience we can have for like a communication partner who is figuring out how to navigate something that is a little bit glitchy or a little bit quiet.
Yeah. Or in my frantic state of trying to navigate tech issues, I'm just thinking about, like, can you imagine what it would feel like as an AAC user to not be able to figure out how to navigate these communication situations where maybe you don't have access to language, maybe in the ways that you have accessible to you, whether that's gestures or facial expressions, et cetera, are not able to communicate what you're actually trying to say, and you're misinterpreted and all of the things that AAC users must, you know, experience on a daily basis if they're not given access to these robust systems. And I'm sure that, you know, that can be extremely overwhelming and frustrating, and partially, I'm sure for many, you know, the reason why we see some of these reactions that we unfortunately misinterpret, right? And place labels on people that are not accurate and are really just a reflection of lack of access, right? That might change if they were given access to the language and the things that they needed in order to kind of correct that and fix that situation.
Yeah. And I'm gonna keep this analogy going. And it would be funny if, like, what if we actually planned this just to put the point across? Surprise, everybody, this was planned. But tell me about your emotional state when we had the communication breakdown. What was going on for you?
Oh, man, I was sweating. I'm sweating over here. I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, nobody's hearing exactly what I want to say. Like, what did everybody miss? I'm frantically trying to figure out what else is accessible to me. Should I get on my phone? Should I get on my iPad, which we're on now?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Trying to figure out, my laptop is not working. It's uploading whatever update. Great. Perfect timing.
Of course.
Yeah, it's always the prime time, but it just kind of makes me think right back to, like, I'm using different modalities to access technology, right? And trying to think about that, and my iPad, my phone, my laptop, and all of the things. But if you are an AAC user and you have exhausted the modalities that are available to you, right? Especially when we're considering Gestalt language processors, and your stress levels are increasing, and you're kind of potentially jumping back into some of those stage one gestalts that you might be using for self-regulation as you're kind of freaking out, right? Because you're not being able to communicate whatever it is that you're trying to say. I just think that it's just horrible. And I just so wish that that mentality that I feel that I used to have, right? Because I think that when you know better, you do better, I hope. But that we kind of let that go, that mentality of AAC is only for those that are non-speaking, and really consider the things that maybe we don't always have access to, even if maybe most of the time we do. When do we not have access to those things or that language, and what could potentially increase that access for that person, and what kind of AAC system could do that? Because there's really no harm in providing access.
And I think the response of us as communication partners, and our responsiveness, our choices after communication breakdowns too, can be make or break. Like, imagine if you came back into the episode and I was like, why did you do that? Why weren't you? What happened? It would be a completely different experience. We'd probably never speak again. You know, the breakdown would continue. Or if, like, the chat were full of people who are like, this is the worst episode ever. Like, instead, what happened, which is kind of beautiful, is each time we've had a glitch, the chat has filled with information and people sharing, I can't hear it either. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Everyone's coming together to communicate through typing to try and fix it and repair it together. So it's really cool. It's cool to see. So thank you to everyone who's here live. We appreciate your help. All right, let's take a breath. We got more to talk about. We got more to talk about. Okay, but first, I'm seeing in the chat, because what I did was, while you were doing your very savvy switch from screen to screen, I asked people to reflect about parts of the quote about how autistic individuals can have this poor integration of body scheme representation Atypical reports of pain. And I asked people to reflect on if they have any experiences with this. And we had two really powerful reflections. One is that someone works with birth to three population, so they are just learning and evolving their body awareness. This person says they definitely use parents for all physical prompting with this population due to them being so tiny. And they also shared that they love and they use the One Little Finger song to help with body awareness and following commands and directives, but in a fun way. And then someone else shared, a heartbreaking story. My son broke his hip and was unable to tell the doctor where he hurt. He pointed to his knee. The doctor sent him home with a sprained knee and he ended up needing a hip replacement. Oh my gosh, I am so sorry to hear that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whew. I mean, like stories like that really hit home how important accuracy is, detail is, and the ability to have words like hip. Where is my hip? Because I think I look at a lot of programming, it's like arm, leg, foot, belly, back, but hip, elbow, like bottom of my knee, top of my knee. There's so much detail that to the human body, especially for a body that has interoceptive differences, proprioceptive differences, tactile differences. If a child doesn't even perceive the sensations on a certain part of their body, how do they even really know that it's there in their body scheme? Where we left off in our discussion was I just shared that longer quote about challenges with detecting body sensations, that body scheme representation. And I wanted to give you a moment if there's any thoughts you had about that particular passage.
Yeah, I think just I'm still thinking about that last comment of the knee and having a hip replacement. I just think that makes me kind of reflect back on not only access to language that could be helpful, right? Dependent on the situation. And I think that a lot of the times we might not think something is relevant until it is. Right. And not just programming, but maintaining access to language within an AAC device that, again, doesn't seem quote relevant, but it's not until it is, right? And considering how do we increase access to that language, not just with programming, but also considering motor pathways and how can we make those things easier in all forms of communication, right? How can we increase that access to increasing the ability to point to your knee if you really genuinely want to point to your knee, or pointing to your hip when you want to point to your hip? And really, I know we're talking more about the speech approach to that, but really highlighting on the importance of really collaborating with other disciplines who have expertise and more expertise in those areas, and really collaborating with them in conjunction to what we are also doing as well, right? Like AAC programming and the level of expertise we have can only go so far if we're not considering the physical limitations or the physical disabilities that a person might have, whether that is a person experiencing dyspraxia or limited range of their upper or lower extremities. And I think that that is probably going to stay with me. The hip replacement, and really just a great reminder of making sure that we're not wearing all the hats because we don't need to, and really reaching out to other people and making sure that we're collaborating and making sure that we're, supporting AAC users and Gestalt language processors in the best way possible, even when it doesn't seem like a person might need support in that area, but really taking all things into consideration.
And like a child's body is the one thing they're going to have the rest of their life. And I mean, this conversation is making me just rethink all the kids I'm working with. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't been doing this. I have not been doing this with my clients. And I am feeling very emotionally motivated right now because of the story we just heard. And the person who shared it also just followed up and said that they had the opportunity to speak with some new doctors regarding this topic, which I'm so sorry that you experienced this. And also thank you for advocating, for being really brave and taking the time to advocate based on what happened to your and your family. Thinking about the medical side of it, I have a client now, the client I mentioned, who is going in for surgery on Friday. And I wanted to share some of the things that the family did. We've been preparing for this for a while to help their Gestalt language processor feel ready for something she has never done before, and I hope never does again. How do you explain to a young child who's a Gestalt language processor that they're going to be going somewhere that smells weird and is full of people in coats and they're going to be cutting into her body? How do you, right? That's a huge concept, a huge scary thing, and conveying that, like, after it's over, you might be hurting, but it's for the best. And you know, when kids live in the present moment, and especially Gestalt language processors, they're really living in the present moment, especially early stage. She's about stage one, stage two. So mom and I have been brainstorming about how do we create this cognitive gestalt or this inner picture, inner video of what is going to happen. So here's some of the things that we did. We tried to build a world around what a hospital could feel like, about who the different characters would be. This kid is, she's gonna work in film one day. I mean, she is like a little movie maker. She films her life, she edits, she has other people film her doing things. It's really impressive. So we were thinking, okay, for a kid like this, how do we build a language world around things she's never experienced? So we found videos of characters going to the hospital, talking about their bodies. They went absolute like overdrive building her body knowledge, especially about her belly button, because they're working on a hernia. All about like belly button. Like, what is this thing? What does it look like right now? What might it look like when you come out of surgery? They used really fun, snappy language that's memorable. They're calling it New Belly Button Day. And like just creating this little package of meaning. It's a memorable phrase. Watching these videos. And I think a really cool thing that they did to help build this world was they got her toys, a toy set that was like a mask for anesthesia, a stretcher, a lot. It's like basically like a toy set about like surgery, which is so cool that people even made that. And what they've been doing is she's been acting out like her stuffed animals and dolls going into surgery. So they've been trying to build the language around it in this very GLP way of creating a small world, learning through videos. And those are just some of the ways that they've been building her vocabulary around this, so that when she goes into this new environment, she's already got an emerging linguistic world about what's going to happen to her body, who's going to be doing it, and why.
Yeah, I think that's really cool that she had access to the toys that she has. Like, that's really cool. I think that I've been seeing a lot of small businesses creep up on my For You page with a lot of other toys that are really similar to that, just if anybody would benefit or if your clients would benefit in the future. I know that there's baby dolls with like G-tubes now. Aww. And with cochlear implants and things like that. So I think that's really awesome that we're able to kind of introduce some of those more complex and unpredictable medical situations in a way that is, you know, and the way that kids learn, which is through play and really introducing those concepts and
I just think it's really difficult with not knowing exactly how it's going to play out, right? I mean, we can prepare and talk about these different scenarios, but I mean, kids are brilliant and trying to kind of come up with different play schemes, which I can only imagine that her play schemes are different and they might kind of go in different ways as she's kind of doing her scene. So I think that's really awesome, the way that they're trying to prepare her and the access that she does have with her toys.
And I also, it was an example of what you had just mentioned of like connecting with other team members and other forms of expertise there, because her OT brought in and found an actual mask that's going to look and feel like the real one. And so then they could practice and talk about it beforehand. And then they were so sweet, they actually sent it home with the family this week so she can have it. So it won't be a brand new sensation. It won't be a brand new visual. It'll be something that she's already had. She's already built an understanding about. So I'm really nervous, but I'm excited to see how it goes. And then the last kind of thing that mom's going to do related to when we think about gestalt processing is this is an experience where this is a huge experience for a little kid, especially a little kid who's neurodivergent and processes the world in a unique way. And she is probably going to need to process the whole of it, the whole arc. So I talked to mom today and I said, what do you think about filming as much of it as possible?
I was just about to say that. I was just about to say, how cool would it be? I mean, the situation is, of course, not great.
Yeah.
But how cool would it be for her to have access? I don't know if this is an AAC user or not, but for her to have access to a visual scene within her device that has the different parts of her journey, right? Yeah. Programmed in there and access to language that she might need after, and her going in, prepping for the procedure and leading up, and a picture of what the office looked like, and what a conversation starter and a great way for her to advocate in a medical setting moving forward, right? Like that is something that is going to inevitably come up, and she might actually be able to participate in and share that information with other medical providers about what she experienced and what ended up happening during that time. I think that is so cool that you guys are incorporating that into kind of the preparation of her leading up to the procedure.
Yeah. And being able to process what happened, especially because there is a phenomenon where under anesthesia, some people, it does lead to not just not remembering that part, but having wider amnesia for a certain degree of time after. And if that were to happen, if there is video of her experiences after, I think that might help this child who doesn't miss a trick. Like, she's one of those kids where I'm like, you are going to remember every detail of your life. You're going to be one of those GLPs. But being able to provide her with that full picture to review, to study, to speed up, to slow-mo, to chop up, to edit. And like I was saying today, I'm like, she's going to make a documentary about it, you know? Like, she can really make her own documentary. But mom is really excited to do that. And I think, yeah, being able to program that in her AAC, which the family's already doing, anything that she shows interest in, they make an icon for. They make a button with that video clip on it. Because this kid also loves to practice. She will watch things over and over and try and get her mouth to form the words. And the last, I keep thinking, gosh, there's so much coming up, but because this could translate into a technique or a practice for those who are listening, is the hospital that they're going to, mom found a video they had made where there's a little girl narrating every step of the process. And you watch this little girl go into the hospital, go through the procedure, explain, even the blood pressure cuff. They put it on my arm. I feel it squeezing it. Like, they made this great resource that is so perfect for a gestalt processor who might need to see the whole of it to understand the parts. And this kid has been watching it nonstop. And mom sent me a picture A really good sign that this kid is interested in something is if she takes a video of the video. So mom sent me a picture of the video that the hospital made on the iPad and this kid taking a video on her phone. And I was like, okay, we're in business. She's trying to integrate all this information. So I'm just so grateful that the hospital did that. And I think that could be a point of advocacy. If you work with or network with places like this, doctor's office, any sort of dentist, oh my gosh, my clients in the dentist, oh my God, I want to cry when I think about that. But could this be a point of advocacy of, would you guys be interested in making a video from car all the way in and through back to being back in the car for these kids? Or if they're not open to it, or maybe even like, could you do a travel session and do that and create a video of the whole thing? Those are places we can really get creative about. Can you create the whole of that experience so the child isn't just going in and experiencing it for the first time? You've almost created the movie set in their brain beforehand.
Yeah. And I'm with you kind of mentioning how fantastic her memory is. I'm almost thinking of, can you imagine how dysregulated she could potentially be if she does have, you know, these parts of her journey through the procedure that she doesn't remember at all or temporarily, and how scary that could be.
Yeah.
And having access to that in visual or auditory ways, right? If we're programming phrases into her device, and how reassuring, I guess, that could be, especially if she has no remembrance of the procedure. That is horrific. I would be mortified. Yeah, so I'm glad that that's something that is already being prepared for her. And I know that I've personally had a client who had a wonderful dentist. I was like over the moon when they told me about this, but they were able to actually go in and essentially do a trial run with their dentist, who was extremely affirming. And I guess offered this on their own. This was something that they had to request. They had offered it. So they went in, I think actually a couple of times, and went in and said hello to all of the secretary staff and walked around and were able to sit down and looked at all the tools at a really like not busy hour where it was, I can't remember if it was the beginning of the day or late in the day where everyone's packing up and getting ready to go, but really forming that positive experience with them going and making sure that they're aware of at least what to expect and what tools are there, and forming as much as possible, you know, within that short, brief period of time that they were in there, but recognizing some of the staff. And I think that was extremely beneficial for that particular family, where it was still a scary experience. I don't think that many of us probably like the dentist, myself included. I still get nervous myself, but I think that it was really cool. And that specific family did the exact same thing, where they have videos of them at the dentist and are slowly adding on to some of their other medical providers and have that readily available. So when they do have those conversations of, hey, we have a dentist appointment coming up in 2 weeks, they can reference that visual scene within the last time that they went to the dentist. And I think that a lot of my Gestalt language processors really enjoy that aspect of programming, because I really do try as much as possible to incorporate my clients within that process of programming, and having them take the picture if they're able to take the picture, or picking the picture that we program for this specific phrase or idea. And I think that's been wonderful with kind of building those new memories and kind of decreasing that stress surrounding those situations, which of course is going to increase their ability to have access to the language that is going to be needed in those moments. And making sure it's available, of course, in different ways, you know, whether that's AAC or if they have access to mouth words. But I just think it's so important, as much as we can, to kind of present information in just different ways and how to incorporate the different modalities that we have available.
Yeah, I think just bringing it back to the basics too of AAC, I think, like when we speak about AAC, it's kind of a given. You know, in our experiences of being speech therapists, it's like, yeah, AAC. But there are still plenty of people for whom AAC is like, I'm not sure, or it's new to me, I'm unfamiliar. And there are myths and biases about, okay, well, if we use AAC, what if it impacts like spoken language development? And like you and I, to you and I, and to maybe a lot of listeners, it's like, oh, hasn't this been debunked? Like, don't, isn't this like old news? And you know, there's studies that show that it's like a neutral to positive benefit on spoken output. But I did want to reference one study, just so people who are listening can have a takeaway if conversations like this come up. It is a paper by Pope, Light, and Lobsher called "The Effect of Naturalistic Developmental Behavioral Interventions in Aided AAC on the Language Development of Children on the Autism Spectrum with Minimal Speech: A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis," longest title ever. But they did a systematic review of interventions, NDBI interventions with AAC and those without. Both of them had great impacts, but the effects were notably larger when AAC was included. And so just papers like that, it's like, just bring it in, because that myth comes up a lot. You know, when I work with families who are new to me, if they just received a diagnosis, there's always like, okay, but what if that impacts spoken output? So I think it's always good to have some papers in our back pocket.
Yeah.
Sorry, was there something you wanted to share? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, for sure. I mean, I think it's good to have those handy, but I think it's also, especially with the specific parent or population that you're trying to support, right, is trying to keep in mind like how the information is going to be most accessible to them. Like I have a lot of families that are not necessarily going to read a research paper if I sent it over to them, right? But there are fortunately a lot of information now on social media and a lot of families sharing their AAC journey. And I think that that's been really helpful for my families in particular, that they are much more on social media rather than skimming through some research articles that I keep in handy for anyone that wants them. But I've shared other families who are also on that journey and tried to connect them together. And I think that has been really impactful too. And sometimes it's just, you know, if they're kind of in the gray area of, I'm not sure and not hesitant, maybe, maybe not, I don't know what I want to do in terms of AAC, is really kind of introducing the topic gradually and seeing what happens, right? And I think that really seeing the difference and the impact has been really helpful for a lot of my families too, that are kind of skeptical, I guess, of AAC implementation. And I don't think that I've ever had to this day a situation where I've introduced AAC and it has gone horrific. And it's like, no, we're not going to, it's always the opposite of that. I've never had a situation like that thus far. It's always been exciting for the client, at least, right? Even if the family is still kind of iffy on what exactly is happening, because I get AAC can be really new and taboo for a lot of people, especially with the topic of, I don't want to introduce screens, right, to my child at 2 years old and so on, with people kind of lumping AAC into screen time and recommendations for kids at different ages and so on. But I think that keeping that in mind too, when we're having conversations with families, school staff, and so on, is considering what their learning style is and how can we provide information that is crucial for our clients and the way that they progress with the language that they have access to, and making sure that that information is actually accessible to them, and not just accessible, but they're going to be able to absorb that to move forward with giving access.
Yeah, and there were two more thoughts in the chat that I want to make sure I touch on. And what I'm going to say about them is actually about looking beyond AAC and GLP and really trying to loop in other professionals, because I think both of these points speak to something that bigger that might be going on, and kind of knowing where our scope, our scopes can get blurry sometimes. But these two comments, I think we might want to encourage the families to look beyond. One that was shared is, I have a student who reenacts a recent head injury, sometimes hitting herself with a hand or object to the point of self-injury and tears. I try to redirect and distract with limited success. I also try to avoid the subject of boo-boos, doctors, and hospitals for this reason. Do you have any suggestions? What immediately came to mind for me is that this event was so distressing and traumatic that this child is trying to reenact it, to understand it, and integrate it. This feels, and I can't know what the child's resources are or anything, but this is a child who I would want to get into play therapy so that they can play out that scenario in a way that is safe and appropriate for their developmental level and maybe integrate what happened to them in a story. It seems like they're trying to reenact it over and over again to make sense of it, but they're not doing it in a way that's actually helping to move through it and release it. And I am certainly not trained in that area, but a play therapist would probably know what to do with that. The other one I'm going to quickly jump into just because of time is any advice for using the videos with kids who become obsessive about watching YouTube and become very upset if it is available, but they are not allowed to watch the specific thing they want to watch. This definitely comes up for me. The kids who get really stuck in those loops, those are the ones I often refer out to find out if there's comorbid OCD going on. Because if they're in a loop with the videos, sometimes it might be like a motor loop. It might be a relationship with that video or that the effect produced by the video that might be a bit beyond our scope too. But I've just seen that pattern of the kids who get very sticky with certain things. Very often it's revealed that they have that overlap of diagnoses and needs. All right, we're going to pause there. We are at time, and I want to give a big thank you. Brianna, it was great to talk to you. It was cool. It's so cool that the ways that the conversation went and some of the anecdotes that popped out. I didn't even realize the conversation I had today perfectly matched up with what we talked about. Can you share where listeners can find your work and learn more about you?
Yeah, of course. You can find me on various social media platforms. So I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook and TikTok. That's primarily where you can find me. But I also am on Teachers Pay Teachers. If any of you are looking for additional resources, I have some resources pertaining to AAC. I'm very passionate about making sure that the resources that I have available are in English and Spanish. So all of the information on all of my platforms are in English and Spanish as well.
Great. And thank you all so much for joining. Make sure you get credit for attending by taking the quiz. And we hope to see you at the next episode of the Gestalt Get Together. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's podcast. Remember to go to speechtherapypd.com to learn more about earning ASHA CEUs. We want you to get credit for the hard work you've put in to further your education. We also appreciate your support. We'd love for you to write a quick review of the podcast and subscribe. If you're listening on a streaming platform, feel free to rate us. 5 stars is great, 4 stars is awesome, but we also appreciate honesty around here if it's lower. That way, your ratings and your reviews will help get our podcast to more clinicians like you, as well as parents and people from other professions who might benefit from learning about Gestalt language processing. Now, if you've indicated that you are part of the ASHA registry and entered both your ASHA number and a complete address in your account profile prior to the course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to ASHA for you. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to be reflected on your ASHA transcript. And also, please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you would like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. We'd love to hear who you want us to interview, what topics are on your mind, and where you'd like us to investigate when it comes to the world of GLP. I hope to see you at our next episode.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.